got a Bible, we're going to be, excuse me, in 1 Peter chapter 5. And what will be the final lesson in this series, Faithful Amid the Fire, covering 1 Peter. There's two words that come to mind when I think about this letter in terms of overall picture. One that obviously comes up is the word suffering, because so much of what he writes about, I can think of specific examples in every chapter, predominantly in chapters 1, 3, and 4, where he is focused on their suffering. Clearly, these were Christians that were enduring persecution, and he is giving them exhortations and instructions on how to deal with that persecution. But the other word that comes to mind is the word salvation. He begins the letter talking about salvation, reminding them that they have been born again to a living hope. They have an inheritance that is indestructible. God is going to protect it until it's ready for them. Because it's important when you're going through times of trial to be reminded about what the future is going to be. That no matter what happens here, that our future is secure. And that's where he starts. And so those are the two things that come to mind when I think about this letter as a whole. And you're going to see both of those things come up here at the end of this letter. Both suffering and salvation. But the first word in our text this morning is the word humble. Just sang a song about humbling yourself in the sight of the Lord. The first word is the word humble, and it ties directly back in with the end of what we looked at last week, specifically verse 5. And I said last week that I hated to break verse 5 and 6 apart, but I did it anyway. But if you go back to what we looked at last week, the first five verses of this chapter, Peter is directly addressing elders and giving them instructions. And then in verse 5, he turns and he says, those of you who are younger, which I interpret as everyone who's not an elder. He tells those who are younger to subject themselves to the elders. Be humble before the elders. And he then expands it and says, everybody, all of us, clothe yourselves with humility toward each other. So be humble toward elders. Be humble toward each other. And then we pick up in the first word of this verse, and he says, humble yourselves. But in this case, it's toward a different subject. And so I'm going to begin. If you've got the back of the bulletin as a handout, it's got three blanks. The first blank this morning is the same as the last blank last week, because it's the same topic. It's the word submitted. Submitting to elders, submitting to each other. But then now he says, humble yourselves therefore under the mighty hand of God. And so submitting to elders, submitting to each other, and now finally submitting to God. You know, so much of what is written in the New Testament is about the concept of humility. That really the choice between God and the world is a choice between God and self. I believe that most of us, if not all of us, are born with the idea, the inherent idea that we put the weight of our lives on our own shoulders. And choosing God means letting go of that idea. Now, I don't think it's possible for us to fully let go of that idea. You know, we have that song that begins, all of self and none of thee, and it ends with none of self and all of thee. My mentor, Dr. Connolly, used to talk about that as the last verse was a prescriptive verse. It wasn't a reality verse. You can't really have none of self and all of thee. But the decision to follow God is ultimately a decision to let go of that faith that we have in ourselves and make a decision to put the faith in someone else. And he describes God in terms of his mighty hand. God is a force that is beyond our comprehension and is also beyond our resistance. We cannot resist God. If we choose to leave the light, leave the faith or the weight of our lives on our own shoulders, we're going to face the consequences for that. But if we give that up and submit to Him, be humble before Him, then as He says at the end of this verse, He's going to exalt us. Not because of what we have done, but because of what He did with His mighty hand to deliver us by sending His Son. And so I made a little note that Peter ends this letter where he began, talking about ultimately our salvation. Who are the ones who are going to receive the salvation? They're the ones who humble themselves before God. They're the ones who are going to receive that eternal glory. They're the ones that are going to have to receive salvation. But in between where those two things I've already emphasized, being humble before the mighty hand of God and being exalted, he has this phrase, at the proper time. And that's a tough phrase. Because what Peter is saying is, your humility before God must translate into patience for His timeline. For His timeline. What does that mean? It means we don't know when this is going to be received. Right? We don't know when eternity is going to begin. We don't know when the trials of this life are going to be over. We're on His timeline. We're on His timeline. This week I watched a documentary. It wasn't a documentary. It was a segment of last week's 60 Minutes. I love 60 Minutes. But I never got to watch it growing up because it's always on Sunday night at 6 o'clock, right? But now in the modern age, you can either record it or you can watch it later on YouTube. And if I see a topic that I like, I look at it. And usually I enjoy learning about something I didn't know much about. And this week I watched, I think it was 13 minutes, a snippet about the French, or a expose about the French fashion house. That I now know the name of this is Hermès. Hermès. Back in many years ago when I was a consultant and I was doing work in New York, right across the street from where I work was at the New York Stock Exchange was one of their stores. And I thought it was Hermes, like the Greek god, messenger god, the god Hermes. I thought it was Hermes. I'd never been in one. I'd never heard of it. And you look at that and I go, it's Hermes, right? I mentioned this also, the New York Stock Exchange, I was told before day one, I worked there for 5 years, I was told before day one, you wear suits to the New York Stock Exchange. You don't wear sport coats and slacks, you wear suits and ties. But I was the only person in the building that had on a bow tie. I mean, the only one. And one of the guys that we had another company that we partnered with to do the work up there. And one of the guys from the other firm, he said, I bet you got a lot of ties. And I said, I do. I have a lot of ties, a lot of bow ties. He said, well, I want to take you somewhere that's got great ties. And I said, all right, let's go. And we walked across the street and we went in what he called Hermès. Hermès, I think is what he called it. Again, I've learned this week the name is Hermès, but whatever. Hermès, I think he called it. Went in there, and I was like, whoa, I am in the wrong place. Because the first tie I picked up, bow tie, $300. I was in there about 5 minutes, and then I walked right back out. But when I saw that name pop up as a 60 Minutes expose, I was like, hey, I want to learn a little bit more about this company because clearly they are outside of my price range. I'd like to learn a little more about it. And what I learned was this is a $200 billion company that to this day makes everything by hand. They do not use machinery. They do not have assembly lines. Every product that they make is made by a single craftsman, one at a time. Including what the whole thing just about was about. Talk about how in the 1800s they began making saddles. And to this day, everything that they make still has a saddle stitch in it. The same stitch that they used when they made saddles. By the way, they still make saddles. I hate to know what those cost. But they still make saddles. But their number one product are handbags, purses. I didn't know this. I don't know anything about handbags. But their handbags start at $9,000 and go up from there. Everyone, handmade, single craftsman. It takes a craftsman 2 years to learn how to make their one handbag. And then they make the same handbag over and over and over with the saddle stitch. But they tan the leather, they stitch it, they do it all by hand. Well, because it's all made by hand, and these things are, even with the cost, are in crazy demand. And one of the things that the expos they talked about was that if you have enough money and you want one of these things, you can't go into a store and buy them because they're backed up for so long. Said normally if you say, I want this type of bag, this color, you're looking at a 5-year wait. And the person doing the interview kept saying, well, but how? How do you still survive in this kind of culture where everything is, I want it right now. You know I have the money. I know what I want. I want it right now. And he kept saying the same word. If you want to do business with us, you have to be patient. He said, we can't make them any faster. He said, if you want our products, you've got to be patient. You'll receive it when it's ready. And while I found that a little pompous, I started thinking about that, though. That's really the same deal we have with God. If we want His salvation, it's on His timeline. It's not on ours. It's not on ours. And that's what Peter's saying. It will be at the proper time. Peter didn't know when that time was. We don't know when that time is. Peter was told by Jesus, no one knows, only the Father. And Peter's saying the same thing. Part of humility is you got to wait. You got to wait. And it's a concept that's tough for us in today's culture. But he says you got to wait. You got to wait. And then in verses 7 through 9, he deals with the other big theme of this letter, which is suffering. And this is almost like quick hits of final exhortations of what to do in the midst of suffering. Okay? Again, he's been dealing with suffering throughout this letter. And he says, hey, while you're waiting to receive this salvation that's promised to you, while you're waiting for an end to this suffering, here's my final instructions. Firstly, casting all your anxieties on Him because He cares for you. So first instruction is, cast your anxieties on God. And clearly, if you are enduring trial, that will create anxiety. And sometimes, anxiety can be its own trial. I have been one who has struggled with anxiety, worry, mental health in my life. And sometimes anxiety itself can be overwhelming. But he says, whatever is causing your anxiety, whatever it is, cast it on God. That's the first exhortation. I've tried very hard in this series to point out the parallels between Peter and other writers, or the times when Peter is reflecting the words of Jesus. Paul in Philippians chapter 4 simply said, be anxious for nothing, but in what? Everything, with thanksgiving, let your requests be made known to God. He says, say, if you're anxious about something, if you're worried about something, if you got something that's overwhelming you, take it to God in prayer. And we can't forget that he throws that word with thanksgiving in there, right? He said, well, what if I'm not thankful? Remember, those of you that were here last Sunday night, we talked about the problem of suffering. Sunday night. The problem of suffering. We talked about free will. talked about the reasons why God allows us, even though God does not create suffering, He does not create evil, He allows it to happen sometimes to us because He's working for our eternal good. Sometimes we may need to endure some suffering to be able to build our endurance. I heard a preacher one time say, if you have nothing else to be thankful for, thank God that He's working for your eternal good. Even if you don't understand it, which most of the time we won't, thank God that He's working for your eternal good. And Peter here says the same thing. If you have anxiety, cast it on God. Tell God. Open your hearts. Tell God what's on your mind. Be open with Him in prayer. The next thing, be sober-minded and be watchful. And he says, your adversary, the devil, prowls around like a roaring lion seeking to devour. But he says, be sober and be watchful. This is the third time, I think, in this letter he has said, be sober or be sober-minded. And I think that underlines the seriousness of this. Take this seriously. Take this seriously. Why? Because this is the most important thing in your life, your faith. And if you're enduring suffering for it, understand this is a serious deal. It's a serious deal. And he says, be watchful. And it brings back what I just alluded to, where Jesus was asked the question by the disciples, what's going to be the sign of your coming and the end of the age in Matthew 24? And when Jesus ultimately answered that question quite a bit later, he said, no, regarding that time, no one knows. And later he said, because of that, because you don't know, stay awake, which is another way to say, be watchful. And Jesus' explanation from the end of chapter 20, Matthew 24, all through 25, about how to stay awake, about how to be watchful, none of it is just sitting on the couch and looking, right? That's not what being watchful is. What is being watchful? Going and living out your salvation. Go live it out. Go live it out. Live out what you have received. That's how we be watchful. You think about the parable of the wise and the foolish virgins, the parable of the talents, about being prepared, about doing, about taking what God has given us and using it to further His kingdom. He says, be sober-minded, be watchful. Why? Because the devil is out there looking to devour you. And regarding the devil, he says, resist him. Firm in your faith. Stay firm in your faith to God and resist the devil. You think the devil is working during times of trial and suffering to try to pull you away? The devil's going to hit us when we are most vulnerable. Looking for ways to cause doubt. Looking for tough ways to cause us to go back to putting faith in ourselves. And Peter simply says, resist him. Kind of brings to mind the words of James, resist the devil, what? He will flee from you. Right? Paul, in the Ephesian letter, in Ephesians 6, talks about using, he uses this as a beautiful metaphor of the armor of God to resist the devil. And what he's really saying is, use all the resources that God has given you. Salvation, Scripture, prayer. Use all the resources that He's given you to fight against the powers that you don't understand. Resist Him and stay firm in your faith with God. And this is a reassurance, the fourth thing. Knowing the same kinds of suffering are being experienced by your brotherhood throughout the world. It says you may feel like you're on an island. You may feel like you're the only one that believes the way you do, that feels the way you do, that faces what you're facing. But I'm telling you, so Peter says, I'm telling you you're not. I'm telling you, you're not. If you're enduring suffering for the cause of Christ, there are others who are enduring suffering for the cause of Christ. If you feel like you're alone, there are others who feel like they're alone. You're not the only one. You're not the only one. Paul said there's, you know, no temptation that has been faced that is not common to man. Again, we may feel like we're alone, but we have brothers and sisters all over the world that are facing the same things that we're facing. And then there's this word in verse 10, the word and. And in this case, that word, which is a connective word, is really a word that shows us a contrast is coming. Because Peter has just been talking about the works of the devil. And that the devil is, he's seeking to devour you, destroy you. How can he destroy you? Well, if he gets you to give up your faith in God, you're going to be destroyed. If he gets you to doubt in God and you let go of your relationship with him, then that future that we're looking forward to is not there. It's not there. So that's what he's trying to do. But this case, and is showing a contrast between the work of Satan and the work of God. And these last two verses that we're going to look at, there's a few more verses in this book or this letter of conclusion. We're actually going to mention Silas as one at the end. Those of you that are here Wednesday night in Acts 15 in the Jerusalem Council, we talked about Silas. I believe that's the same person, likely the same person, the same one that accompanied Paul on his second missionary journey. But these last two verses we're going to look at, I've given it the word sustaining. Sustaining. Because he's talked about how you're going to have to wait for God's timeline. And while you're waiting, you may endure suffering. And here's my instructions for what to do. But this last part, I think, is hold on. Hold on. And he says it this way, and after you have suffered a little while. By the way, I don't think little while means your suffering is going to be short. I think it just means while you're here on this earth. Because compared to eternity, this is a little while. No matter how long we live on this earth, it's a little while compared to eternity. But he says, after you've endured while you're here on this earth for a little while, the God of all grace who has called you to his eternal glory. That is a summary of the work of God. If Satan's work is to devour, what is God's work? God has been working from before the beginning of time to call us to his eternal glory. Right? And Paul in Ephesians chapter 1 said it was before the foundation of the world that he knew who he was going to save, those who had their faith in Jesus Christ, his son. And he says, that's what his work is. That's the opposite of devouring. He's been working to save us from the beginning of time. But he says, the God of all grace who has called you to his eternal glory. So you see, that and marks a sharp contrast between what Satan is doing and what God has already done and continues to do. But he says, the God of all grace who has called you to his eternal glory in Christ. By the way, that's how God did it, in Christ. That's how God accomplished his work. Will himself restore, confirm, strengthen, and establish you. And this is where I think Peter is really emphasizing this idea to hold on. And he does it, the emphasis comes because he says God himself is the one who, when the little while is over, he personally is going to restore, confirm, strengthen, and establish you. Suffering is going to end. Trials are going to end. Glory is going to begin. And Peter, in a subtle way, is saying, it's going to be worth it. Hold on. Hang on. Yes, trials are tough. Yes, suffering is tough. Yes, this life can be tough. But he says, it's going to be worth it. Hold on. Hold on. It's going to be worth it. And again, I've talked about Paul and James already. Let's talk about him again. James says, blessed is the one who remains steadfast under trial, for he will receive what? The crown of life. That's what our future is. Paul said it in Romans 8, verse 18. He says, I consider that the sufferings of this present time are not worth comparing with the glory that will be revealed to us. And I think Peter's saying the same thing. God himself is going to end your suffering. He's going to give you glory. He's going to restore you, strengthen you, establish you, confirm you. And in view of that, he says to him, meaning to God, be dominion forever and ever. Amen. And he's saying, because of the work God has done, he's worthy of all honor, all praise, all glory, because he has done what was impossible for us. And if you hold on to that, you're going to receive glory because of the work he has done. And that's the way he ends it.
It's going to be worth it. So he ends it again where he began. He began by saying, you've been called again to a living hope. You have an inheritance that is indestructible. And he ends it saying, God's going to personally come and strengthen you, establish you, confirm you, restore you. He's going to bring you into his eternal glory. But who are the ones that are going to be part of that eternal glory that are going to receive that free gift from God? The ones who remain faithful to him and his son. And that choice begins by making a decision. We're going to live for someone else. Again, that doesn't mean we're not going to trip and fall. That doesn't mean we're not going to make mistakes. That doesn't mean we're not going to sin. But it means we have a new master. We're living for someone besides ourselves. And we continue that choice with our baptism, being buried into the death, the burial, the resurrection of Jesus, the way God completed his plan. We submit to that. If you're here this morning and you've never begun that journey with Christ, or if there's anything else we can do for you, please come. Jeff leads us in the invitation song.